Hi, you're listening to Talking About Organizations, a podcast about management and organization studies brought to you with the support of the ICON Research Center at the University of Warwick. This is episode 18, part 2, where we discuss gig economy and algorithmic management, inspired by an article published in Financial Times by Sarah O'Connor. For more information, please go to our website at www.talkingaboutorganizations.com. If you haven't listened to part one yet, please go and do so now, as this is a continuation of that discussion.
What intrigues me about this, one of the aspects of algorithmic management that intrigues me is the idea of taking managers or human bias out of the loop, and that somehow that produces more fairness or egalitarian approach to work. And certainly you can't eliminate bias of managers, and there's some level of favoritism, or they may interpret ways employees are working that is different than what a machine might do. But I kept thinking about the comment that the Percolatus founder made when he was talking about how the software tracks sales per employee, per square foot, per hour.
Oh yeah, that was such an interesting example, though, wasn't it? Because the setting that it was used, the 7-Eleven, it's not really a hard sell kind of place. You know, people come in there already pretty much knowing what they're getting or having some clear idea what they're after. So tracking sales per square foot per hour in a convenience store certainly seems a bit, you know, strange. It doesn't seem like the correct setting for that kind of measurement and control,
yes.
Isn't it?
Yes. So he's transported himself into the brain of the worker to say, oh yeah, this is how the workers are going to respond to a machine telling them what their performance is. And I'm thinking, from my experience as a manager, you have enough trouble as a human being looking somebody in the eye and saying, you need to step it up a bit, or your performance needs improvement in these areas. And there's this wonderful faith in technology. I come back to that again and again. But this idea that a manager, you know, the managers can't do that, or you have to have that it's better to have an algorithm do that, I just find astonishing.
It's not just that. There's also a significant self-regulating element to it, because the assumption is that, okay, if an employee wants to have more rewards for their work, so i.e. higher pay, then they need to think to themselves that, right, I should work harder. And that is just so naive, because primarily this assumes that employees always have more to give, that they're somehow not working to their full extent, that they're holding something back.
Right, or that they're holding holding back, or soldiering, as Taylor called it. And if you just think a couple steps ahead, you say, well, what if the employee doesn't really understand how the metrics can pertain or connect to their individual performance, and the employee doesn't know what to do? How does the employee go to the algorithm manager and say, well, I'm confused, or I think I'm trying as hard as I can, or I must be misunderstanding something, and taken to its maybe not logical extreme, but taken to another couple steps, how do you have any kind of meaningful interaction with an algorithm that says, you know, you should be doing X? And so that's what this idea of, well, better performance just comes from measuring things, right? A very engineering, scientific management kind of approach, as opposed to saying, no, motivation plays a big role. And do I really think people are going to be motivated by getting an email every month saying you need to step it up? That's I just find surprising.
I really like what you brought up also, was this issue of the extent the employees are involved and they understand the system. Because, you know, I think there are many things conflated here. You know, to play devil's advocate, one of the things that Percolatus says is that this standardization, in a way, makes it more clear the way that schedules are done. And there is indeed evidence, you know, in the catering business and retail stores, that people are subject to kind of coercive schedules in which they never know when they're going to work or not. So standardization in a way helps that. But there are different ways to standardize. And then I thought about Toyota, and the, I would say, classic example of the way you can have employees keeping track of their work in the way Taylor would, But then they have the power to decide how they're going to change their tasks. And they themselves can decide, you know, what they feel to be the best process according to the annotations, according to the calculations, but they are brought into the system, which is, you know, again, we are saying that algorithms have politics, and in this case, it just assumes that's the only way to standardize, but we know from the literature that's not necessarily true.
Well, and another point about the Toyota approach, or what is oftentimes called the Toyota production system, is that at its core, it's about learning. And learning about the job better. And it is not obvious to me that just giving somebody metrics is going to cause them to learn the job better, particularly if you say, well, okay, so Ralph, you're in the store from these hours and the sales percentages were X, but Pedro had that higher percentage, so we're going to pair him with you, or we're going to do some other thing, or Pedro's going to get more hours. And I'm thinking, well, what if I sincerely want to get better? What's that telling me to do differently, right? And I guess I'm making the same point over again, but there's this idea that there's the human understanding and learning that's built in, not necessarily built in, but it's part of the Toyota system that's completely taken out of the equation here. So there's that learning aspect. As somebody who's a very interested in adult learning, I find not disquieting.
Yeah, I mean, I suppose it raises also an interesting question about the type of work, or, like, you know, production activities, or type of sectors to which this kind of management systems can be applied, right? It's like, maybe it can work to the extent that, you know, you have like fairly simple tasks that do not presuppose a lot of learning, but, like, to what extent can something of this kind be, you know, scaled up to other kind of work activities in which actually, you know, there is a more complex, tasks at play. I mean, not to say that retail work is not complex, but actually there's huge amounts of sort of, like, emotional, and interpersonal labor that goes into it, and in itself is not actually maybe as simple as we think. But you know, it really, for me, like, raises this question of, like, this idea that, which, I mean, it's also raised a little bit at the end of the article, right? This sort of assumption that somehow this is the new way of doing things that is going to, like, spread and eat away all the, you know, standard forms of organizing work. I mean, to what extent is that the case? Like, if we think of the complexity of labor tasks, and can everything really be simplified to such an extent that it just becomes a matter of measurement, and all the learning and all the interaction and all the social aspects of the work process can be taken away? I like to think that it's not possible, but I don't know. Maybe it is.
Well, isn't that in some regards the exact opposite of this knowledge economy and knowledge workers, right? Where there's all this other value-added things that people do, and that, sure, there's things you can defer to robots or very simplistic ways of managing and doing things. But to me, this idea that you can take these jobs, you know, any job, or and that's some of this approach to the service work, and descale it, or basically just say it's all about the numbers and revenue you generate per hour and square foot. I mean, what I wonder about the learning aspect of this, and this is something that I think I'd be curious to hear from Ariana, is there was a learning that went on post-Taylorism when the workers and were organizing and they were getting unions and we were empowering the workers. So there was a power dynamic there, but at another level, there was a learning on the part of management to say, oh, we have to treat employees differently. And the labor unions created a voice for the employees, so the leaders and managers could learn that there are other things they have to consider. And then when you look at this kind of work, and in the gig economy, where it's the workers are all completely independent and don't even know who each other are to some extent, Ariana, do you think that really complicates the potential for future managerial or learning from the about how to be more successful, or what it takes to support the workers in the gig economy?
There's a lot of issues that that, you know, your question brings up, Ralph. I think there is, it's a very thorny issue in terms of what does the gig economy and, you know, technological developments mean in terms of labor relations. First of all, is there a possibility in which, you know, trade unions or other forms of workers' organization could somehow overcome the individualization of the employment relation that, you know, the platforms facilitate, and somehow reinvent forms of collective action? And can this power imbalance be redressed, and ultimately, you know, can some sort of exchange about the dynamics in which labor is, and the ways in which work is organized happen that result in some form of learning, as you define it? I think, you know, I tend to be, you know, I want to be optimistic in terms of, you know, I think the examples that are brought forward in the article, in terms of, you know, the new waves of like wildcat strikes that took place over the summer, like, you know, with Deliveroo and Uber Eats in London, point to, you know, a revival in a sense of labor agency in those forms of work organization where, you know, they've been assumed to kind of be dead, you know, like this assumption that, oh, the gig economy workers are totally unorganizable and there is no collectivity anymore. And actually, like, these point to, you know, very concrete ways in which some form of collective voice can still be leveraged, and that can ultimately probably lead to, you know, a realization on part of, you know, this platform that actually the model is not sustainable in itself, and therefore, you know, you also need to take into account the fact that the workers on which you rely to run your service are also like human beings that need to socially reproduce themselves, and therefore, you know, they do need to, in order to continue even to be able to perform that labor, some form of income security, some form of, you know, sickness safety net in case they get injured, and that, you know, at some point the mechanism will start breaking down if you completely dehumanize the process. So I think, you know, in that sense, I think it's not completely, you know, hopeless. But then again, if you look at the scenarios in which this happened, are those aspects of the gig economy where there is still an element of, you know, physical presence of the worker, right? Like, the process of management happens through an algorithm, but at the same time, like, the labor is still performed, you know, in the context of Deliveroo or Uber in a physical sense. These are like actual drivers that get on the road, that ride their bikes, and so that can potentially like meet each other, be physically present in the same place to, you know, whatever, do a picket outside of the offices. But if you think of the other aspects of, you know, the gig economy, which are completely just based on online platforms, like, you know, all the micro-tasking platforms and all that, you know, then I become a little bit more skeptical about the possibility for collective action, because, you know, really, then you don't have any sense of, like, geographical co-presence of the workers that can facilitate this this leveraging of collective action. I mean, I think maybe over time online communities of taskers will develop, but I'm not sure to what extent you know, that is forthcoming.
Can I play devil's advocate a bit? I really like Ariana's analysis. But when I was doing some research online before our meeting, I came across an article called "Lyft says robots will drive most of its cars in 5 years." And it's exactly about Lyft's, which is Uber's rival, plan that, you know, you're already starting in specific paths to have autonomous driving cars. And then in 10 years, in principle, it's going to be everything autonomous. And I have this idea that, you know, no one's going to own a car. We're just going to use services and, you know, have this the robots, in this case, driving us around. So to offset this, the more rosy side of Ariana's, I would say, great discussion is that, you know, maybe, and to go back to what Ralph was saying, what does it have, what, how is this related to the knowledge economy? So I think it raises the question of, are these tasks eventually going to be automated?
And is that necessarily, you know, a bad thing? right? That's I think that for me is the interesting question, right? It's like in itself, the idea that we could free ourselves from having to do a potentially not particularly interesting job, like driving the car, because the car will drive itself. You know, if this development was inserted in a set of relations of production in which the benefits that come from that automation are shared, you know, kind of equally or redistributed, then that could be great, you know? It could mean that, like, we can only do work that is actually interesting. And you know, that would be an announcement of human freedom. The problem is that in the context in which automation happens, you know, within a framework of, I suppose, you know, profit maximization for those companies that drive it, then what happens to those workers that used to carry out those tasks, and how can they be compensated, I suppose, for the loss of labor opportunities, right? And so I think, yeah, in itself, like, automation is neither good or bad. It just all depends on you know, the relationships of the social relations within which it happens, right?
Right. So one of the things I was thinking about when you were talking about the social relations was the quote in the article from the former U.S. Treasury Secretary. And he said, the question is how to protect workers while at the same time garnering and reaping the benefits of change and innovation. And I think both Ariana, you and Pedro have both talked about this, those opposite sides or those pieces of that sentence. And what I wonder is, all right, so if you create ways that you manage workers or workers participate or the language you choose, but it eliminates the ability for workers to negotiate and convey their concerns to leaders and the management because you're just talking to an algorithm, how are you going to balance those social relations, or how are you going to find what works when you've set up the situation where the workers can't talk to each other and they're basically just talking to the algorithm is what manages them? So it's a very curious challenge, I think.
I was just going to say very quickly, I think Rariana was touching upon that when she said something about online communities. You know, the very, I would say, virtual aspect of algorithm is also, I mean, there is no reason why we cannot exploit the virtual communities, the virtual world, to recreate bonds, you know?
Yeah, and I think maybe that's possibly like the next frontier, in a sense, is trying to understand how, you know, it's not like social, you know, hierarchies and relationships of power don't suddenly go away simply because we remove the sort of face-to-face or human aspect of management. And so in the same way in which potentially solidarity and identity maybe can be recreated even in new settings, which are not the traditional settings of the work, of the physical workplace, or of workplace-based forms of solidarity. Mm-hmm. I think there has been some research done about sort of online communities of taskers, and how that there are some forms of kind of like emerging social bonds that, you know, emerge, you know, come up in Facebook forums where different people that work for like Amazon Mechanical Turk kind of like give tips to each other and sort of like talk about common issues that they have, maybe with customers and so on. But I suppose what was interesting to note in this is that all these communities also always clustered about some other forms of social identification, which existed, I suppose, not in the virtual world. For example, they were, I don't know, groups of, you know, that all of taskers that all shared, however, the same nationality or the same language. And so kind of like, can we really transcend the sort of, you know, old forms of identification and recreate communities and forms of solidarity in the virtual sense? I mean, I think it's probably going to come, but it may take a long time. And then I suppose the question that Ralph was raising is like, what could get lost in the meantime, right? Like,
yes, that's what I'm talking about. Because, what I find interesting about Ariana's comment is we may go down in a direction where these can be resolved, and I think it just won't be the way we envision it now. The through that process of negotiation and social interaction, these things may in fact work themselves out, but it's hard to imagine this minute. you know, what that process will. But I share some of Ariana's optimism that we will find ways to work it out. It's just what I would call a head scratcher at this moment.
Yeah, and I mean, I think, you know, one can neither be too fatalistic and predict, you know, the end of the potential for like the end of labor agency, nor, you know, just the trust in the fact that everything will just be fine. I think it will need a very deliberate engagement, I think, on parts of workers' movement, but also in general, like people that are concerned with issues of like quality of work and innovation and social fairness, I suppose, to figure yes. out like new forms of regulation, new potential public policy responses, but also from the managerial community, I suppose, you know, like to an interrogation of whether this is necessarily a desirable trend, which I don't think it is, also for, you know, even seen in a very instrumental sense.
Right. One of the things I've noticed by taking many Lyft and Uber rides is I do a lot of talking to the drivers about how they like working for the company and how they manage their time and those sorts of things. And I found out that pretty much all the drivers I've ridden with, they monitor both Uber and Lyft at the same time. And they'll take whichever ride appears to be closer. And I asked somebody on a ride from the airport once, well, if you had your choice, who would you take all your rides from? And the person said, no doubt about it would be Lyft, because they pay better per ride, and they also have incentives that encourage you to be out and getting rides and being more active. And so what that taught me was, as a customer, since I do support what they're trying to do, is if I can have a choice between one or the other, I'll always take Lyft because it's better for the drivers.
Yeah, exactly. And so I've actually heard similar discussions about potential to introduce something akin to fair trade standards for, like, you know, online platform of task outsourcing, right? You know, this idea that, well, you know, if we can't leverage workers' power in the same way, at least we could maybe switch the focus on customer's choice in terms of saying, well, you know, this platform at least, whatever, treats their workers a bit better or gives better terms and conditions. And so, you know, creating a different logic of how to improve the conditions, right? But then again, that requires some level of initiative and, you know, potential like certification
yes.
of that. And who's going to do that?
Yeah, so I think we have been talking about, let's say, the undoing to the system that the gig economy does, you know, reflecting the way it restructures labor, employment, and so on and so forth. But I wonder, what about the creative destruction, only destruction that it causes to the system that we have in place? You know, so when I think about Uber, I usually think about the strikes that were done by taxi drivers. And in some places, there is still some resistance, you know, whether it's legal or not. And even if it's legal, there's people that, you know, say that you are actually undoing an infrastructure that's already in place and substituting for it and so on and so forth, which is something that this article doesn't touch upon, because you're only looking at the people that work.
Yeah, and I mean, I think there is a lot of displacement that happens as a result of, platforms of this kind of like inserting themselves into an existing, you know, set of infrastructures, like a local political economy, and then suddenly this is thrown upside down. And I mean, I think it's the same going back to the Airbnb example that we were discussing at the beginning of the episode, right? It's like this whole notion that, you know, you suddenly have something like Airbnb that completely circumvents existing regulations on renting, on taxes, on
yes.
like, and there's actually in a lot of places a lot of protests by local residents, you know, that
yes.
you know, in terms of like the housing crisis
yes.
that the widespreading of Airbnb as a platform is creating, in the same way in which, you know, Uber is displacing the livelihoods of taxi drivers and potentially like other, you know, online platforms that offer other sorts of admin services, maybe displacing, you know, your more traditional forms of doing this kind of admin work. And and I think that there is a real, I think the debate is what is the role of, you know, at least for me, like, you know, I'm interested in also the role of the state or like of the law and of regulation in terms of like defending existing infrastructure, or is that stifling innovation? I mean, it's a very interesting debate to have in terms of, you know, what is the responsibility of the existing regulatory systems to engage with these new platforms, right?
I don't know what is happening around the world, but I think in Brazil, the only place that has been regulated, it is in São Paulo. And so Uber is legal now. I suspect that the Lyft and the others are as well. But what they did is that Uber has to pay a certain tax to the city. You know, I think it's like $1 per, I don't know what it is, but they exist, they're accepted, but they're monitored and they pay some tax. So this way, you know, you can accommodate for these new things. And then you still, I think the state still maintains some oversight on that, which I think is in a way important.
Yeah, and I mean, it's the same thing in you know, a lot of municipalities that are starting to introduce like requirements on, you know, Airbnb to like pay local taxes or, you know, at least not to undermine the local rental market, you know, beyond a certain share. But then again, does the fact that Uber pays some taxes help those taxi drivers that have been displaced? Or should we just be saying, well, you know, taxi drivers, you should get on Uber as well, because that's the new way of doing things. I mean, I suppose it's the same debate around, you know, like the Luddites were having, like, you know, back in the 19th century when their jobs were being automated and they were like, wait, you are displacing us and our livelihoods. And at the end of the day, supposedly modernity wins. Is this the best desirable way in which we can manage innovation? I suppose it poses a lot of questions about, you know, what happens to those that are inevitably hurt by processes of technological innovation like this.
Well, and also I think when you look at you were talking earlier, Ariane, about the automating of certain kinds of jobs, like, you know, perhaps taxi driving or perhaps driving, and I was thinking about one of the other aspects of eliminating that kind of work, those kind of entry-level jobs, is it raises the skill and expertise bar for many people, right? So even if you said there was a minimum floor on being a taxi driver, and basically you need to know your way around, you need to operate a car, you know, that kind of stuff. But then we step it up a couple notches and say, no, there's all this extra stuff you have to know, whether it to be a taxi driver or somebody who does maintenance on the robotically driven cars. That makes it very hard for people to find ways to actually get into the workforce, because there's a lot of research that's been done on the training aspects of people, the very first job, and how people progress and develop the skills for future work.
I'm really glad you mentioned that, because I was also thinking about this while Ariana was talking, this ideal that technology would allow us to get to a point in history where we only do as people jobs that we want to do. Well, in that case, the jobs that we want to do become a coveted privilege amongst the few that would be
right,
high enough or privileged enough in society to be able to pick. And what happens to the rest? Is it that they have to be much more qualified, as we discussed, to do even the lower-end jobs? Or is it that there's no jobs for them at all? Like, thinking back to ancient societies, for instance, the ancient Rome and ancient Greece, is that the people who got to do things they wanted to do, they were supported by these hordes of slaves, essentially. And presumably, we're not going back to that.
Yes.
We have technology now, but what happens to the people in that case?
Yeah, and I mean, also the example that Ralph was referring to earlier about the taxi drivers having two platforms open at once and then, you know, kind of having to navigate the process of choosing which one is more convenient. Actually, there is an awful amount of labor that goes into the very process of accessing work, right? You know, it's like,
yes.
Suddenly, like, something that used to be quite simple, like, yeah, you drive a car for money, someone pays you for a ride, and then suddenly, you know, there's like all this system that you need to navigate, and I guess an increasing, I mean, I don't know if it's bureaucratization is the right word, I can't think of a better term right now, but, you know, there's a lot of processes that you need to go through and to be your own manager and to succeed in this fragmented labor market. So yeah, no, I mean, I didn't at all want to suggest that it's some sort of potentially like ideal scenario in which we're all going to be free to just like fish in the morning and hunt in the afternoon and then write poetry at night. No, I mean, I think absolutely, like, in the current context, is actually, it's a very scary set of set of developments. That's for sure. I suppose I just was going to mention something that came to mind, and it's also quoted in the article, is professor Guy Standing, who has written extensively on the concept of the precariat, and how new employment relations are being reconfigured in such a way as there is, this very vulnerable class emerging at the bottom rung of the labor market. And he actually advocates in some of his writings, I mean, I'm not an expert, but for what I remember, this idea that maybe there's not much that we can do in terms of changing the employment relations. And so maybe the answer should come from public policy instead. For example, he's a big advocate of basic income, universal basic income, as the only way in which, the kind of power inequalities that are, brought about, and the income inequalities ultimately that are brought about by this new reconfiguration of employment relations, can be ameliorated. And so it's basically like, in a context in which people are going to get paid less and less for their work, the squeeze on wages is going to get better, the only way in which we can possibly do something is just to give everyone a flat basic income rate, so even if they are exploited by their workers, or even if by their employers, or even if they have to bear more and more risks on that used to be borne by employers in terms of business insecurity, at least there is a social safety net, and maybe that is the only way in which we can go. So, I mean, I know this lies beyond the topic of the podcast as such, but I think it's an interesting perspective. At least in terms of like, okay.
Well, there was a vote in Switzerland not long ago on exactly this, whether to allow for a guaranteed national income, and it didn't pass, but it certainly demonstrated this is a live debate in at least some parts of the world right now.
Yeah, and I mean, it's a big issue for trade unions everywhere, right? Like, because potentially you're kind of giving up on the idea that in the employment relation is where the struggle on the wage and on the means of social reproduction happens. And you kind of say, well, okay, maybe the global relations of power in the employment relation have switched to such an extent that we cannot win concessions from employers anymore. So we're just going to get, the state to provide that safety net. Maybe that's letting employers off the hook a bit too much,
Well, what I think is an interesting aspect of that, Ariana, is that whether it's a guaranteed public guaranteed income or some other form of public intervention or governmental intervention, like Pedro was talking about in Sao Paulo, it does suggest that that's a tool that may be used in the future. I don't want to say useful per se, because I don't really know, but it's a tool that may be used more in the future to maybe level the playing field or give workers more of a voice or introduce some other features that are not really part of the gig economy or this algorithmic management. So I think it's an interesting idea that public policy is the tool, or a better tool, because that you have limited access or ability to impact the algorithm. So that's what I find interesting about that approach.
This seems like it's almost like mediated industrial relations.
Yes.
Because what we discussed about apps doing something similar to what Taylor did with isolating workers or distancing workers from each other and from the clients. So this is almost as if public in form of government is stepping in to mediate the relationship on behalf of the employee. And whether that is a delivery rider or an Uber driver, or this other trend of where management consultants get gigs through apps, so whether it's low-skilled labor or even knowledge labor, it's still, the effect is the same. And it seems that this is trying to mitigate this this consequence, almost this idea that that might be the way how industrial relations are represented in the future, where direct contact between the employer, employee, and client is no longer as unambiguous as it is now, or as it was in the past anyway.
Yeah, exactly. And I mean, I think it basically poses the question of, I suppose, strategy for the labor movement is like, where do you leverage your demand, right? And maybe in terms of reorienting strategies, and saying, well, in a context in which we cannot necessarily leverage our influence on the employers as we used to be able to, then maybe the state or whatever other regulatory body is in a position to impose some form of either regulation or at least put in place a safety net, should step in instead. It opens up all sets of challenges. But again, I think it shows that there is still the potential for action and agency and amelioration of things, and so not all is lost in terms of like workers' rights, I suppose, which I find as an industrial relations scholar very heartening and encouraging indeed.
One thing I wanted to say, that this may not be the case in all cultures, but in the United States, sometimes it is not direct regulation that changes how these interactions occur. It's the implied threat of regulation. And what the U.S. Congress will do is they'll hold hearings and they'll bring managers or Uber or Google or somebody in front of them, and they will basically say, here's these issues that we have going on, and we've heard from the workers and heard from these people. You need to go work this out, otherwise we're going to regulate you. And many times that gives the companies tremendous incentive to seek out alternate forms of resolution before, you know, waiting for the government to regulate them. So that's another strategy that sometimes is used in the United States.
Okay, well, but the reason that works is because there's still access to the owners of the businesses, the managers and the CEOs and the capitalists, if you will. But algorithmic management has already removed that for the employees, who have no access to managers most of the time and have to interact with the technology. So what if we take this line of thought further, and what if we are in a situation where there is no access to the owners and CEOs? That's
the matrix.
Well, it's a challenge. I agree with you. It's not a simple problem.
I mean, the scenario that Dimitri paints is not, you know, too far off, maybe not in terms of like the physical aspect as such, but like the legal blurring of responsibility, right? I mean, I think there are a lot of corporations or like economic agents that exist in the sort of like digital globalized economy, and it's very hard to regulate their operations because they cut across existing sovereign boundaries of nation states, and if you have legal whatever headquarters in a place, but actually you don't have a single employee in that place because all of your supposed contractors are task rabbiters spread all over Southeast Asia, to which a completely different set of labor regulations applies, then how can you enforce any labor standards in that context, right? And so again, the question of the geographical dispersion that the digitalization of labor processes allows for poses very serious issues in terms of regulation, which I don't think there are very many solutions for yet.
Well, it's even beyond that, really, because if you think of regulation, it's applicable to trade and employment, and things like Deliveroo and Uber, they have already circumvented the traditional employment framework. So once the traditional trading framework is also bypassed, then there isn't even a regulatory framework which to apply onto such a form of organization.
Maybe I have to expand this scope now, because, you know, as we have been saying, in a way, it is still a transaction that resembles very much employment. But I want to shift this whole discussion about regulation and its implications, not necessarily for the workers, but society at large, you know, because one of the things I have been reading about Uber is that as new competitors come in, and I don't know, as people get excited and start to drive, but then quit, you know, and then I think that was something that was happening exactly in Brazil, from what I read, you know, that people got excited about Uber when it arrived and they thought it was going to make money and blah, blah. But many people actually realized that, you know, it was not a very good bargain. So there's less drivers now. I mean, you can assume they have been replaced by Lyft and so on and so forth. But the point is, transport is, I would say, a public need, you know, is one of the basic services that we have. And in a way, you can consider taxes as also part of the great web of transportation a city has to think about. And then you have Uber, which is completely, in many places, unregulated, I would say, entity coming up, and if it progresses in a certain way, we can imagine that's going to, you know, market out all the taxi drivers and become the new infrastructure for transportation. So what it happens when you're in the hands of Uber in that situation? Or what about Uber decides to leave a country and then you're left with nothing in place? So there's also something about regulation that's not a possible impact, the direct impact it has on employees, but also the system we have in place for a number of basic needs in society.
So you're thinking about these companies taking on the strategic infrastructure, essentially. So power stations and utilities and things like that. So basically,
I don't know,
Uber, for instance, rolling out self-driving yes. buses that would replace city transport and stuff like
right.
that.
Well, here's the flip side of what you were saying, though, which I think is very important, is what if instead of Uber saying, well, we're going to leave the country after we've completely transformed your transportation infrastructure, which, as you said, is a very important social and a public feature or benefit or task, would it also give them much a better or higher negotiating power? So if the state says, well, we want you to pay yes. this tax, or we want you to treat drivers this way, and then that would put Uber in the position of saying, no, if you don't do what we want to do, or if you levy excess regulations, we're going to walk out and you'll be left with nothing, or you'll have to completely reinvent this infrastructure that is gone now. So that's the other aspect of that sort of that change in power dynamics that might create.
Well, I guess that's where liberal market capitalism and the invisible hand of the market come in to save the day, don't they?
Yes, of course. I forgot about that.
But, I mean, I think, yeah, Pedro's point raises lots of interesting questions about, I guess, how the you know, these innovations in terms of management of the employment relations then also overlap with questions about the so like privatization or externalization of public services and you know, the increasing sort of public-private mix in the delivery of you know, supposedly essential services like transport and yeah, you know, what power does that leave of, you know, or what guarantees does that offer to the public service users that, you know, that service is going to be guaranteed, even maybe if it's not profitable for the company as such. I mean, I think, yeah, it's a big question. There was actually an article on The Economist just last week, I think, on, you know, Uber and the future of the transport system. And I'll circulate the link so we can put it up with the podcast notes. It was kind of talking about how globally Uber and the whole self-driving car investments that they are leading on to are potentially reconfiguring the transport worldwide. So I guess, yeah, the implication of this go far beyond just the world of work, and I guess it's the political economy of public services in general could be reconfigured. And what are we going to do about it? I don't know. I don't know, but I think I should probably, you know, consider dropping what I'm doing.
No, finish your PhD first.
Yeah, exactly.
No, don't do that.
Futurescaping, yes.
Well, I actually, I was going to say, I've met in the Academy of Management, I don't remember the name of the person, but she was an ethnographer from the US, and she had done an ethnography with Uber. You know, she drove Uber and talked with Uber driver and so on and so forth. And one of the things she said that actually, no, left me puzzled was that, you know, she said almost like a trivia. She said, so do you know what a person has to do to drive an Uber? Like, no. So basically you have to enroll, register, and then Uber asks you the name of three people that can vouch for your driving skills. And then she said, I put like my mom, my dad, and like my boyfriend, whatever, friend. And then the person says, is it a thumbs up or thumbs down the way so-and-so wrote? Drives, and then if it's a thumbs up, it's fine.
There you go. You can see, it seems like
that could be bad if your mom is grading you. Uh oh.
Yeah, but yeah, I think I was
exactly.
I was reading an article. I think, I don't know if he's the same person, but there is this former PhD student called Alex Rosenblatt, which I think has done extended ethnography of of Uber drivers and, you know, kind of documenting all the sort of ways in which actually, like, the supposed flexible and like freedom enhancing technology is actually still based on all sort of forms of you know, social control and also, yeah, it's like, I mean, the vouching system is in itself also kind of still shows that you can't really completely transcend from social relations, I suppose, even for the functioning of this platforms. But
Well, and speaking to the drivers, one of the things I ask the drivers is what do they, how do they choose what rides to pick up, or what's their the decision process? And they said, oh, we look for the ratings, because not only do you rate us, but the drivers rate you. And we will prioritize somebody who has consistently high ratings over somebody who has lower ratings from the driver. I thought, oh my goodness, that's a good incentive to behave yourself in the car and be a nice person.
So I think what Ralph is saying raises the question of our roles as consumers, because we are the ones using those services. And, you know, in the same way, you know, that, you know, you might not want to use or buy from a store that use, I don't know, slave labor. It's like, what does it say about us when we engage in these forms of employment? I mean, these, we engage in these arrangements of work in which we know there are some negative sides for those doing that. So.
Yeah, and I think the other interesting point that, that Ralph's point raises about, you know, the role of consumer is like what we were talking about earlier, and like in terms of maybe the role of the manager is reduced in this new arrangement, but the role of the consumer as a tool of management and control through the mechanisms of rating and feedback is actually greatly enhanced, right? Because in the moment in which, you know, your ratings become a factor that could have you deactivated, and you know, the your performance in terms of the feedback that you receive becomes a one, you know, your primary target tools, and you know, and your primary sort of like performance management tool, it's kind of like creates a very interesting reconfiguration of the management relationship in which there is this new triangle in which the consumer or the service user actually has loads of power in this relationship, right? And I mean, the damage that a bad review can do to a driver could be huge. And yeah, are we aware of that as consumers? Are we aware of the responsibility that that this our, you know, sort of innocent usage of a rating app or something can have for the livelihood of people? I mean, it's actually quite scary, right?
Well, that's a great point, because one of the Lyft drivers told me that somebody gave him, I think, a 3 because there was some confusion with the Google, the Maps app, whatever application he was using to negotiate this particular part of town. And anybody who's used those tools frequently recognizes every now and then it does get confusing about where you're going to be. And the woman gave him a 3, and he wondered, you know, did she really understand, was that a fair assessment, since he was, you know, her comment was, well, he should have known where he was going, right? That there's this expectation that my ride should have been perfect and he should have known everything. And then this other aspect of, as Ariana was saying, which I thought was a great point, and is that do the consumers recognize the power and influence they have through those ratings, such that they may rethink the rating and say, well, okay, I was frustrated because the person, you know, didn't know where they were going to go, but that power is amazing. It has an amazing impact and could get them dropped from the service. You know, that's a very interesting question.
Well, I think there's two things that are quite noteworthy in that situation. One is that this person riding and rating the Uber driver, I don't think she's rating the driver as an individual. I think she's primarily trying to rate Uber, because that's what she's interacting with. She's hailing the cab through Uber, she's paying through Uber, she is rating through Uber as an app. And it, just because it happens that she's sitting in the back seat of a car driven by a person, which, as we discussed, may be a temporary arrangement, that doesn't mean that she is necessarily acknowledging the individuality of the person. It comes back to what Ariana was saying in part one of the episode about the dehumanization of labor through algorithmic management. But at the same time, she can't, and any customer can't rate the company directly. So you see, even though they're rating through the app, their perception of service, which is promised to be uniform and of equal quality and standard, the person cannot rate the organization. So, for instance, with Airbnb, you rate the host. You don't rate the Airbnb. With the Uber, you end up rating the driver, who just happens to be, you know, this conduit for rating Uber. And that's primarily an issue of accountability. Thus, by shifting accountability onto the employees, but at the same time dehumanizing and almost hiding them behind the application, there is a gap where the organization is left unaccountable, even at the same time as it holds its employees accountable for its service. Do you see?
Yeah, it's a very interesting. I mean, I think I see this as another aspect of, I don't know, like externalization of business responsibility, right? It's like in a context in which users are, you know, they can only rate the individual driver with which they interact, even though maybe their dissatisfaction actually surrounds like the business model as a whole, and the fact that, yeah, like drivers maybe don't know where they're going because they don't have control over what rides they accept. They don't know the destination, and they may end up in areas where they're not familiar with. But, and that's, you know, a fault of the design in the sense of Uber, but somehow that is that risk that is completely shifted onto the individual workers, and I guess it's part of inherent part of the business models in which the platform only extracts profit and takes no responsibility at all for enhancing the quality of the service, if not by, you know, sort of disciplining and monitoring its contractors. I mean, it's genius from the point of view of what the platform does, like, and the fact that they get away with it. I mean, it's crazy. Like,
well, an example that my mother taught me. My mother was a server in restaurants for many years, and what she taught me was that many times the success of the servers is actually largely determined by the manager, because if you push too many people into the restaurant such that the serving crew can't really give them the quality of service that people perhaps expect, it's not really fair to take that on the server, because it's the management's job to say, well, we should only seat people at a rate the servers can provide service to them. So, all right, you got a great point. In that environment, as a restaurant customer, I've been taught by my mother to look for things like that. In fact, I just had a bad service experience that was caused by the manager a couple weeks ago. And yet, in the case of Uber,
so is that how you ended up with that many chilies?
Yes. it's related to that same trip, so yes. but in the case of Uber, how do you access that? How do you just, you know, see that the algorithm is what's setting the drivers up for perhaps failure in a particular case?
So we want a rating system for Uber, for Amazon, for Airbnb in themselves. That should be our policy.
Yeah.
Yeah, and to empower the users themselves to maybe understand and navigate, you know, the intricacies of the, you know, the power relations within which they enter when they use the, you know, the services totally unknowingly. And, you know, like, I often find myself reflecting on it when I use Airbnb, and I'm like, yeah, of course I'm going to use Airbnb. You know, I can't afford to go anywhere else if I'm going to a conference. But then it's like, oh gosh, what am I doing?
You're ruining the local economy.
And I'm being an agent of gentrification and so on. But I mean, it's really true. It's like, I guess, like responsibilizing consumers or like service users to be aware of the ethics of these platforms in the same way in which, you know, it happened in the global supply chains around the garments industry. Like it took a very long time for that sort of awareness to emerge and for the idea of like ethical standards as something that mattered. I guess maybe that wave will also come in service provision of this kind, but it needs to come from somewhere. And I suppose, you know, the level of the subtle layers of exploitation that a Uber driver undergoes are maybe not as visible and, you know, easily understandable as one of like a child laborer in a garments factory, right? And so I guess the process of making labor visible, as we were talking at the beginning, is particularly important as a, you know, in the process for improvement or like social change around these issues, right?
Yes, definitely. Beautiful. Something else that's important that we discussed is this whole idea of catching up the social with the technology. And we've discussed a number of times during the episode that maybe it's supposed to be the other way around. Maybe the people developing this technology ought to have a closer look at the social aspects and social consequences of the things they're dealing with. Because, okay, so we had scientific management of Taylor, but we also had 80 to 90 years of development in human resource management and human relations and industrial relations development since then. But by reverting in this weird way through algorithmic management to this uber Taylorism, pun intended, that it negates all that knowledge and all that sensitivity that we developed as scholars, as managers, and as employees, which I think kind of ties nicely with one of the central topics and purposes of this episode, whether this can be justifiably called Taylorism. So as far as I'm concerned, while I see some tools and techniques that bear resemblance to what Taylor outlined in the Principles of Scientific Management, the orientation is misguided and the ideology isn't there either, which are both very important. So I really don't know whether this is Taylorism on steroids, as the article suggested.
Yeah, and I would say, so the way I would modify that statement is, it's the misuse of Taylorism on steroids, because a lot of what Taylor was trying to do, and the spirit, as Pedro had mentioned about the concern for the workers, that was completely lost because people went off in this other direction and just picked the parts that they liked, disempowering of the workers and the de-skilling of jobs. So I tend to think of the algorithmic management as the misuse of Taylor on steroids.
I'm just curious, what would a Taylor on steroids look like?
Wow.
Oh my God, Dimitris.
All sort of images are running through my head now.
Exactly.
Are you imagining actual Freddie Winslow Taylor pumped up on steroids there?
You know, the biceps or something.
Well, here's one way to think about it, right? And so you guys can let me know if I'm way off. But one way to think of Taylor on steroids would be perhaps the way Peter Drucker talked about the knowledge economy and the knowledge worker having essentially all the power or the ability to innovate. And so it was management's job to support the knowledge worker so they could produce best value. I do believe that's at the spirit of what Taylor was trying to accomplish through scientific management and design of the work. It's just that innovation wasn't such a big part of it. So to me, that would be Uber drivers who had not only the flexibility, but there was a way to say, hey, you're not paying me enough, or this isn't fair, or so they would have a voice in the algorithmic management. Or you would give them the ability that we see some in other places on social media to speak up and have some kind of collective voice. That's what I think would be Taylorism on steroids.
I think I disagree because, you know, from what I remember from Taylor, he's not really keen on the voice of the workers. But what I think is that for him was paramount, was taking responsibility for the workers. In a way, paternalistic, but still there.
Okay.
And that doesn't happen with Uber. So the problem is not the algorithm per se, which could still be present in a Taylor, I would say, dream. But the issue is that Uber would take responsibility for its worker. It would never say something like, oh, they're not my employees. Taylor would say, oh, they are my employees, and they better do what I say because I know best.
Yeah, that's a good part of it. I agree with you. That's good.
Although, I mean, maybe something at the same time does, you know, there is some continuity in terms of the complete deprivation of workers' control over the way in which work is carried out and is conceptualized. So yes, I suppose form of, I don't know, is it alienation the right term? But, you know, yeah, kind of like removal of workers' autonomy from the work process certainly right. is in continuity, but I mean whether that is in line with Taylor's vision overall, I'm not sure. But in terms of the
So I'll sum it up with a sentence. Terrorism on steroids would be alienated, but still employed.
Right, right.
That's probably a good place to stop. Well put, Petro. So this was fun. I really enjoyed myself. And thank you so much, Ariana, for taking the time to come on as a guest and participate in the discussion. It was extremely interesting, and I think our listeners will have gained much from what you had to say.
It was a real pleasure, actually. I found the conversation really stimulating, and it's great to have the chance to talk about these topics with people coming from a sort of more organization theory perspective. I think it was incredibly intellectually stimulating.
And that is all for episode 18. Thank you so much for listening. We hope you enjoyed this episode. It was definitely fun for us, and it was a first of its kind where we actually tried to apply our discussions of classics of management theory to contemporary issues and ongoing discussions. Next week, we're releasing a summary as per usual, but until then, this Thursday, the 13th of October, the podcast is turning 1 year old, and we're going to release a special celebratory mini episode to commemorate this milestone. Thank you all so much for joining and supporting the podcast through your listenership, and we really do value each and every one of you. So I hope to see you next week as we summarize this topic, and the next episode is going to be on another one of the Carnegie Mellon School series focusing on knowledge exploration and exploitation. Here on Talking About Organizations.